Hello, I'm Julianne Good, and this is Psych One-on-One. Welcome. We are here to make psychology more understandable with tips for you, your family, and friends to make your lives easier. Welcome to the evening. We are in downtown LA, and it is a nice 72 degrees here, so I hope you're keeping warm in your part of the world. Tonight, my special guest is Dr. Trevor Daniels, and we are going to be talking about Black psychology and Black psychologists. So welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Yes.
Good.
Yeah. So can you give the listening audience a little bit about your background?
Well, I am trained as a community psychologist, clinically trained. I have done a lot of work with diverse communities, pretty much substance abuse, HIV, AIDS, that type of thing. For the last 12 years, I've been teaching graduate school. This is the first, you know, perhaps time I haven't really, you know, taught in a while. So this academic year, I'm taking a break, you know, just to, you know, sort of build my own things and, you know, seeing what's out there, what, you know, new opportunities, things like that.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks. And it's good to have you back, too, because I had you on last year and when we were at the old studio for Skid Row Studios. So nice to have you back.
Yeah.
So what is the importance about talking about Black psychology and Black psychologists this evening?
Well, if you remember when we talked last time, we were talking about, you know, police violence and just what seemed to be an upsurge in Black communities of color. And when we spoke, you know, I sort of talked about this idea that, you know, there is a context, you know, for all of this stuff. And so when you talk about Black psychologists, Black psychology, we're really talking about paying respect to the context in which people live. And you, unfortunately, there are not a lot of Black psychologists out there. And you'll hear in places, you know, academic institutions, you know, people who are studying now, you know, this need for a lot of Black male, you know, therapists in general, especially a lot of Black male psychologists. But when you think about the idea that we all exist in some type of context and we carry that context with us when we are out, you know, interacting with the world, you know, it's sort of important when it comes to mental health issues, when it comes to community violence and, you know, all these other ills that are affecting different communities, that there are people who understand that context and can provide services within that context. So that's why it's important to talk about it.
Yeah, definitely, especially for all the newsworthy items that have been in place lately. I think this is really important that we're talking about this evening because I think a lot of people don't understand exactly what's going on with the Black community and, you know, all the different, like you said, all the different contexts of it, all the, you know, there's so many different aspects of it. So what makes it tricky to be, you know, working within that context?
Well, what makes it tricky is if you talk to people who are not socially justice-minded or who are not multiculturally competent, you know, there's sort of this idea that, you know, if you are trained in mental health, if you are a psychologist, then you can work with anyone. That's only partly true.
Right.
You know, because there is a context and, you know, just to, you know, sort of add a context to it, you know, there's this study out by it's demographics of the U.S. psychology workforce and it's finding from the American Community Survey. And they did this work from 2005 to 2013. And what they looked at were the demographics for psychologists in the United States. Now, there are a lot of statistics. I won't go through them all. But what I will point out is that, yes, there was an increase in the number of minorities who became psychologists.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and they started defining psychologist as anyone coded with a doctorate degree, which is sort of tricky in and of itself. And, you know, as you go through the report, they sort of tease that out a little bit. But so it increased by 100%, the number of Blacks or African Americans who are psychologists. However, when you look at the simple numbers, it's sort of alarming because there were like 84,000 psychologists across the country. And only 2,000 of those were Black people.
Wow.
And then that increased by 100%, which made it a little over, 4,000. So really not a lot when you're talking about 84,000 people across the country, who are psychologists. When you're talking about only 1%, of the population who holds a doctorate degree, only 4,000 of those people, were Black. So
yeah. And why would you say that? What are some of the elements that come into play that there aren't enough Black students going into the program? And I know when I was going through my MFT program at the Chicago school, there were very few of my fellow students who were also Black. So, so I was always kind of wondering what elements went into that. Do you know?
Well, it's hard to say. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the report, points out is that is an area where there needs to be more study. I know anecdotally for myself, I did an MFT program and then, did a four-year doctoral program right after. In my MFT program, I think I was the only Black person, in my cohort. And then when I went to get my doctorate degree, there were four of us. And one, we didn't see, halfway through first semester, she left and didn't come back. Uh-huh. Some people have work obligations. Some people have family obligations. What I've learned from, the students that I had in the last couple of years, especially the minority ones, is that a lot of them don't feel, welcome in programs. They don't feel like the programs are speaking, to minority issues as they should. One student that I had recently, African-American female, early 20s, had an experience where one of the program administrators, said something to her on the meet and greet date that was really racist.
Oh, no.
And that she didn't, say anything most of the semester. But as we got into, the coursework, and I was teaching this course, Intercultural Process and Human Diversity, where she finally started to talk about how this person came up and said, whatever she said to her and thought it was funny. And the student was very disturbed.
Oh, yeah.
And was wondering, is this really the place for me? So, there are a lot of different reasons why people of color, either don't go into programs or drop out of programs. Sadly, I don't think it's studied that much. But that's an area where we need to do a lot more research.
That would be a good thing to research because as you said, there are specialty populations out there, no matter what culture, and it is so much easier for the client or the patient to come to a counselor or therapist that is of their own race, period. It's just so much easier, especially, cultural context, language. There's so many variations of that. And like you said, it's just one therapist does not fit all.
Right.
Or it's going to be a little clunky at parts. So.
Yeah. And it's important to be careful. And, for your listeners, it's important to, understand that what I'm not saying, or I don't think what any culturally competent person is saying, is that, a Black person only can be helped by a Black therapist.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But, it's about people finding, others who look like them, who understand the context, who are aware of their own, biases, and who can make intelligent and culturally relevant interventions. It's about that. And it's about, having that available for people.
Mm-hmm.
And not this, sort of ethnocentric monoculturalism, type thing where, the dominant view is the guidepost for everybody and we're all equal and we should all live this way and think this way and present ourselves this way.
Yeah, we're not quite there yet.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. I know. I mean, there's, we all have good wishes that eventually that happens, but it seems for the steps that we take forward as a culture, then we end up taking baby steps back and sometimes violent baby steps back also, you know? So it's really difficult to, you know, get to that point.
Mm-hmm. It is. And I think, well, you know, here's an anecdotal thing. So, you know, before we started the show tonight, we were, you know, sort of talking about the quality of programs and, you know, how, you know, it just seems to, you know, be going down. Well, you know, at a lot of schools and programs across the board, you have this, you know, student as consumer, you know, type thing. Not that that's necessarily bad, but, you know, sometimes, you know, it gets to, you get this dynamic where it seems like students are running the programs, you know, they're dictating what courses are being taught. And I know when it comes to diversity and multiculturalism, you know, that's a scary topic for people. You know, people, you know, have this sense that we're trying to tell them, you know, who they should be and what they should think. And it's really not that at all. You know, what we're saying is you have to be aware of the way that you think and the impact, you know, that that has on people. And so you talk about taking three steps, you know, forward and, you know, 10 steps back. You know, new students, especially the younger ones who don't have, you know, the history or knowledge of, you know, civil rights movements, you know, whose parents may be, you know, sort of on the younger side, you know, you tell them or you suggest to them that, you know, the world does not start to exist when your eyes pop open in the morning.
Right.
And they take that, you know, somewhere completely different. You know, you're telling me I'm inauthentic, you know, I'm this, I'm that. And what we're really saying is what you think of yourself, perhaps only you were thinking it, you know, and, you know, people are thinking something different. And no matter what you do, people still may have different thoughts of you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to be aware of that when you go into clinical work, especially with people who have had these, you know, traumatic experiences, right, because of their difference. You know, you have to be prepared for the fact that no matter how much you say, you know, you're there to help them, they may be thinking something different about you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's, you know, that triggers people and, you know, they just don't want to look at, you know, their own biases and, you know, and then we get into complaints and, you know, you've been in school and you get the students who, you know, they're going to sue the program because the program is racist. You know, the professor has an agenda, especially if they're black and male, you know, it's crazy.
I know. You know, I had a little bit of issues in my cohort too, that ended up happening there could have been more sensitivity that was instilled into the situation. Mm-hmm. And it made, you know, what may have been a misunderstanding, mm-hmm. it blew it up to the next level. You know, and of course, if the student got emotional about it, right, and then really took it to the next level and started telling other people about it, then you have a whole different mm-hmm. ball game with working with that. So when you're teaching your students about diversity, where do you like to start from?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, this course that I taught, it was a coordinated course, so I didn't create it myself. I actually took the course when I went, because I was teaching in a program where I graduated from. So I took the course. It was drastically different by the time I was teaching it, and it changed, you know, over the 8 years that I worked, you know, with the program. And the person who coordinated the course, you know, for a year and a half or so, you know, extensively studied, you know, how to teach diversity. Mm-hmm. And you really have to prepare, you know, people for, you know, this dialogue. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was a student, you know, it was sort of arcane. You know, this is what the black people do. And, you know, then we're going to have a week on the Native Americans.
The Sue and Sue book. Oh, yeah. I remember that book. I just loved it.
Yeah. And, you know, and when I was in my master's program, you know, it was even worse. And, you know, when I was, you know, an undergraduate student at Miami University, you know, where the minority population was like 2% out of the entire student body. And that's, you know, inclusive of everyone. You know, we really didn't even talk about serious issues. So you really have to, you know, prepare people. You have to, and, you know, I don't want to give a, you know, psychology lesson, you know, to your readers, but, you know, preparation and really having people understand, you know, what diversity is all about. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, this idea that it's not kumbaya, rainbows, you know, things like that. It's, you know, about understanding context, understanding one's own biases.
Right.
You know, understanding that you project something onto the world, understanding that, you know, your identity was comprised, you know, from all of these different experiences that you've had, what you've been told about the world, what you've experienced in the world, you know, things that your parents taught you, you know, all of that. And you take that information and you, you know, create this identity, and then you go out into the world and you project that onto the other people. And a lot of it is outside of conscious awareness.
Oh, yes. It's a lot of it is nonverbal.
Yeah.
And and a therapist, I mean, when you're in dialogue with a patient or a client, sometimes a lot of times you're not even aware of what your nonverbals are saying until you look at the other person, and all of a sudden they seem uncomfortable and stuff, and it's like, okay, what did I put out without even saying it? You know, it's a little scary because there's so many different types of communication at play that we all have to be aware of when we are sitting and trying to help people that are not of our race.
Right. And, you know, and the one thing that I always do, you know, for myself and I always suggest to other people is, you know, insight and awareness. You know, what is sort of happening with me as I'm engaging, you know, with this other person? What am I thinking? What am I becoming aware of? How am I feeling? So there's a lot of introspective work that people, you know, need to be doing. I remember this student always comes to my mind, and, you know, I was looking on one of the social media things, and I see that he's graduated, he's a doctor now, and I remember having him first year, and, you know, he's saying, you know, I'm very open to everybody, and you know, I have all different types of friends, and I had them do this exercise. And when he came back to class the next week, you know, he was literally in tears in class. You know, I looked at this and all of my friends are the same, you know, we all sort of think the same. And now I'm sort of wondering whether or not, you know, I'm fit to be a psychologist. And it's like, well, hold on. You know, don't spaz out too much. you know, the goal is to get you to, you know, to sort of be, you know, expansive in how you think, you know, about others and how you think about the world, and, you know, and allow some space for other people to be who they are, regardless of how you think about yourself and, you know, and the world itself. So I'm glad that he, you know, made it through that process. But yeah, you know, it's, you know, you have to broaden your horizons and really understand that, you know, there is uniqueness in the world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, a long time ago, I was working at a domestic violence shelter. And I think probably one of the most interesting clients I worked with came in with her baby daughter. Now, this is an emergency shelter. So typically, we were having people stay with us for 30 days. This woman was from Bhutan, I believe, and very different from any other person that I have ever met. And we had a little bit of communication problems, but she had this beautiful heart and just this willingness to communicate. So I would sit with her and just talk and just be with her and play with her daughter. And that alone was really healing for her, for somebody to just sit and listen to her. And then she was telling me stories about her homeland and how she ended up coming over to the States and the abuse that she went through in her country. And it's, you know, different cultural standards. And, you know, some of the stories just made me want to cry, but I just like, what a strong woman for making it through, not only where she was, but coming over to a whole different foreign country and setting up roots here.
Right.
Was incredible. She taught me so much, but I had to be open to learning. I had to ask her questions. You know, and sometimes I would ask questions that I probably thought, oh, this probably sounds really stupid once I think about it. But, you know, so I was, you know, I was a little bit embarrassed. She was okay with it. Right. And, you know, we learned to communicate with each other.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because what I used to train, I used to work for a very large social service agency that dealt with women and children in the child welfare system. And the mothers were usually, you know, drug addicted or had some, you know, type of problems with substances. And, you know, very large staff. And so I was training there and then also, you know, with my students. And, you know, my one argument was, you can tell me any type of intervention, you know, for anything. But do you actually know, you know, why you're using it? Do you know when it's appropriate to use it or not? And most people couldn't tell you that. And so what students seem to be concerned with or with very rigid, you know, therapists, psychologists seem to be concerned with is just the intervention. But again, you know, we're talking about context. And so some of those things that we may, you know, deem stupid, the stupid question, maybe I'm not doing enough in therapy because I'm playing with the little daughter instead of, you know, filling out a form or asking questions. You know, sometimes maybe that's just what people need. You know, there's a context to all of this. So, you know, you have to remain open. You know, you have to allow yourself to be open. And I'm not saying that, you know, interventions and theories are, you know, obsolete or we should throw them by the wayside, but they need to have utility.
Exactly. Yeah. I know that's, you know, the deeper I get into my career, I understand that too. And I was trying to kind of explain that to my fellow clinicians today who are much younger than I am. Like, I mean, you can know all the theories in the world, but you have to know how to practically apply them because otherwise you lose people in psychobabble and they shut down because especially if their intelligence level is at a different, you know, different level than yours is, then, you know, you're going to have problems. You're going to have issues. So it's like, you know, just reel it back and use real language. You know, I think that's really important because I think no matter who you have in front of you, you have to have them start rebuilding trust because that seems to be across the board is that people come to us for help because they've lost hope and they've lost trust and they've lost faith.
Right. Yeah. You know, I remember when I was, you know, in the doctoral program and I was talking to, you know, one of my fellow African-American, you know, cohort members. And, you know, she was talking about, you know, another person and, you know, and she was, I think, he, you know, there was certainly, he liked her or something. And, you know, and she was saying, you know, he's always trying to, you know, show me how brilliant, you know, he is. And she said, we're all brilliant. We got into a doctoral program. We're all brilliant. And so, you know, what I say to the students is, you know, I really get unimpressed by how much of the theory you know. Because you have to know that to graduate. And if you don't know it, you know, it's going to be obvious. But the question is, can you apply it? You know, do you know when to use it? Do you know how to use bits and pieces? Can you tell me why you should not be using this intervention, you know, at this particular time? Can you demonstrate for me that you can, you know, understand these people in context and maybe do something that's a little unconventional because it fits within the person's, you know, culture, their values, their customs, you know, that type of thing. And if you can't do that, you're not ready to work with people. But programs are, you know, graduating people all the time, you know, who can sit down and rattle off, you know, the theories and, you know, and the interventions.
I'll show you a few people.
Right. But, you know, they just don't know when to use them.
I know. And it's just weird because it just sounds... To me, it sounds like they're opening up a textbook and reading a page out of it, or they're trying to impress somebody. And I'm not in too. I'm not knocking down the theories and stuff because they have relevance. But you're right. They, you know, it's just it's a nuance.
Yeah.
It's knowing when to use what at what time. That's it. You know, and it's just I think it's so important. You know, to our listeners. That if you are going in for therapy, the first session, at least a first session or two, should be assessment. It should be a lot of questions that are being asked. If your therapist is not asking them and you feel it's really important information, by all means, share it. You know, or write down a list before you go, because of course, everybody during their first therapy session is going to be nervous.
Right. You know, and here's a good example. Well, one, I always tell people, you know, looking for a therapist is like shopping for shoes. You know, you have to try to fit. Don't let money, you know, so guide all of your decision, although, you know, it's a big determinant. But, you know, the example is, so there was a student, you know, who talked about, I presented this case, you know, to a class, and there was this girl who was living, you know, one of the, you know, rougher neighborhoods, you know, in Los Angeles. You know, she was adolescent, preteen, and on her way to school, you know, there were some guys in the, you know, hanging around the apartment complex who'd make lewd comments, you know, things that would really, you know, sort of constitute, you know, child endangerment or
harassment,
you know, those types of things, child abuse, you know, stuff like that, the sexual nature. And so, you know, the student said, well, you know, you got to call DCFS, call the police, you know. And I said, okay, so now these people are going to, you know, retaliate against the whole family. So, you know, maybe people are going to get killed, beaten up, things like that, because, you know, this neighborhood was high violence, you know, crime, you know, gangs, drugs, you know, that type of thing. And it's just like, one, there's something that you have to do as a professional, you know, to protect a child, because a child, you know, is potentially in danger. But you also have to weigh, you know, what your actions, you know, the response, what the response is going to be. And so, you know, by off the cuff, just calling the police, DCFS, now you've opened up this family to potential, you know, harm. And so, you know, at the end of the exercise, we were able to talk about how, you know, perhaps, and I'm not saying don't call DCFS or don't call the police, but perhaps an intervention before you do that is to have some older male, you know, cousins or family members or trusted friends, you know, walk the person, you know, to school, pick them up, what have you. Which was, you know, part of the intervention, and because this was a real case. And once we did that, you know, the harassment stopped. And there were other things that happened, you know, afterward, you know, in terms of authorities. But the idea is you have to consider the context. You know, I've done therapy, you know, in people's homes, where outside of the house, people were getting shot and killed, you know, gang fights. And so I'm trying to have a group therapy and now we have to lay on the floor.
Oh, scary.
What's going to happen when I show up? I had one client, you know, who would stand, you know, they knew what day I came and, you know, older woman, she would stand outside the house. Oh, the doctor's here. Once she stopped doing that, you know, people stopped, you know, sort of looking at me every time I showed up. Who is this person, you know, driving a nice car? You know, is it someone who's trying to encroach, you know, upon our territory? Is the police or whatever?
Right.
So, you know, the way in which we practice really has to, you know, speak to the environment in which we practice and to the people that we are providing services for.
And be respectful of the environment that we practice in.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. While being safe and, you know, watching out for our own safety. I've known quite a few therapists who have done home visits and they told me how dangerous it could be in some of the neighborhoods. And, you know, I'm pretty sure that the general public doesn't know that, you know, they think that we're all in, you know, offices in Beverly Hills.
And right. No.
Not yet.
Not yet.
But, you know, it's we have to work in the trenches sometimes. It's just, you know, it can be dangerous.
Yeah, and you know, most students, or at least the ones I've encountered, you know, their ultimate, you know, aspiration is the office in Beverly Hills. But I, you know, am of the mind that, you know, people need to be out in the trenches to be, you know, adequately trained, you know, plain and simple.
Right. I mean, it's life. You have to mm-hmm. get in there and dig mm-hmm. and be able to put yourself through those challenges.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, you just, you never know who is going to present in front of you and need help.
Right. So I would say that, you know, a good 90% of the students, of all students that I've ever taught that were from L.A., had never been to like South L.A., you know, or East L.A. If they weren't, you know, Hispanic, you know, West L.A., you know, that was their paradigm. Mm-hmm. And the ultimate goal is, you know, the office in Beverly Hills. They've never been to any of these places, don't know anything about the people. And then they go get a job at DMH.
Mm-hmm. You which know, is Department of Mental Health.
The Department of Mental Health, where they are probably seeing, you know, maybe 80-85% indigent clients yeah. who are from these areas. And they don't know anything about them, have had no training, you know, whatsoever.
Yeah, you know, I just had a psychologist on recently, and she said that they were, you know, placing students into practicum, and students were coming back and going, what did you do to me? Because they were in tears. They were just mm-hmm. like, they were in shock. And what do I do? What do I do with this population? I haven't had enough training. I didn't learn about this in the classroom. Right. Or it just wasn't discussed enough, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it depends on, you know, again, a lot of different things. You know, I think I know who you're talking about. You know, some programs... You know, programs talk about, you know, we are socially justice minded. You know, we, you know, are big on diversity. But then when you get there, sort of diversity light, you know, it's really not diverse at all. And, you know, God forbid that a student gets triggered because, you know, you touch upon a sore spot. So, you know, they may be correct. They may not have had the training. I know for the intercultural class that I used to you know, teach with seven other people, you know, the students came in thinking it was sort of a fluff course. You know, they wouldn't read the material. They didn't really take it seriously. And to this day, I still get calls from former students who are in training now or, you know, who have, you know, just graduated, who need some type of assistance. You know, this is what's going on. What do I do? And it's just like, you know, I help them out, but it's like, remember, you know, that class when you didn't read the work and
you maybe know. You should pull out that yeah. textbook that you didn't read in the first place,
you know,
or at least look at some of the references and start doing some research right. as to, you know, if you have a person of a different culture that you feel that you don't have enough training for, you really need to go and do the research.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had to do that with a recent client who was from Cambodia and go and dig a little bit and stuff. And it was fascinating. I was, you know, he was a really good client to work with. So,
right.
you know, it's just, again, just getting comfortable and realizing that we're really here to help.
Yeah, and that's something that we all have to do, whether you are socially justice-minded or culturally competent, you know, or not. That's something that we all have to do. You know, I have a friend, you know, I'm from Ohio, and he's from Detroit, and he talks about, you know, just how great, you know, L.A. is. And, you know, I have to remember he's from Detroit,
mm-hmm.
You know, where the city government stole all the money, and, you know, and he talks about how, you know, I think it's Halloween or something, you know, they burned down the houses and, you know, so a completely different context.
Yes.
And he's African-American as well. And so although we are both, you know, both identify as African-American, you know, his context is so much different than mine, that if I were working with him as a client or, you know, people, you know, from that area, I would really have to do a lot of work to understand, you know, the dynamics of what it means, you know, to be African-American and male, you know, in that context. So, you know, again, it's not, you know, if you are, you know, Black or a person of color that, you know, we have it all wrapped up, we have it all solved. We still have to, you know, do the study as well. you know, we still have to be prepared. So, you know, context is important.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had two women in my cohort. One was from Sri Lanka and one was from Chicago. Both African-American women and completely different worlds. Mm-hmm. It was fascinating to watch them interact between each other because it was just...
Yeah.
It was almost like two different languages because they had grown up so differently. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was fascinating.
Right. And, you know, and so we talk about the difference between people, but what about when in someone's head, you know, the connection, you know, isn't sort of being made. And so I think about this student when I was in my master's program. She was from India, and she was in the lowest, you know, caste system in India. And then she moved to California and married this black man. And she swore up and down that in her entire life, she had never experienced any type of discrimination, you know, or racism. And it's just like, and this guy that she married was a politician and, you know, and all this stuff. And it's just like, how? You know, and I think at the time she was like late 40s, early 50s. It's just like, how, you know, with that background, have you not ever, you know, experienced any type of racism or discrimination? You know, and so I was, you know, sort of disturbed that, you know, the professors never really picked up on this and, you know, no one ever challenged her. You know, I had a peer in my cohort, you know, said, you know, like maybe the first week of school, you know, identified as white and was clearly, you know, not white. Mm-hmm. I had a student who, you know, talked about, you know, not having told anyone in her family that she was in a doctoral program. Well, you know, why? Because, you know, they're going to think differently of me. Well, you're going to be different. You know, what are they going to think, you know, once you graduate and you start making, you know, the six-figure salary that everyone aspires to, and you have this different type of language. And, you know, she just could not handle, you know, the idea that was going to happen and, you know, sort of fell apart, you know, in class.
Oh, poor girl.
You know, another student who, you know, had been abused by his father and was still being abused, you know, who then came to class and projected that, you know, onto me, you know, and other, you know, sort of strong, you know, males who had strong personalities. So you get these people, you know, all the time, and they want to step out into the world and help others. So it's easy, you know, to talk about, you know, the client and how difficult that is. But what about when you, you know, are the difficult one?
Right. You know, and the you equation. Need therapy. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But you can't say that.
I know.
You cannot say that, you know.
I don't understand that.
Can't say it.
I hope to see that change eventually.
Yeah.
Because in England, I do believe that you have to have 1 year of your own psychotherapy, and then you go before a board. At least this was at Tavistock Clinic mm-hmm. when I went there for study abroad. And they were saying a board determines at that point whether or not you are psychologically fit to go and do schooling.
Mm. Oh, okay.
I think I would love to see that instituted in this country.
Yeah, well, a lot of programs, I know mine certainly did, you know, required that you went to psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. You know, you had to graduate, but, you know, beyond, you know, what happened to psychotherapy, you know, that didn't come into the equation. But, you know, people had to go, but, you know, I've run into a couple of people, it's like, really?
and try to get around that, yeah. Right? They didn't really want to know themselves.
Yeah.
That's not good.
Yeah. You know, only one time, you know, when I first started the doctoral program, there was a student in our program who was commuting from one of the other campuses because they didn't have the classes that, you know, that she needed. And she lasted like 2 weeks because she clearly, you know, whatever we were talking about in class, it always ended up talking about her and her husband, who she was having, you know, some problems with. And it's like, that's not even the topic, you know, of discussion or the class. So some people, you know, it's really apparent, mm-hmm. You know, that they are not ready or just not suitable. And others, you know, it's not. You know, it sort of creeps up on you. You sort of see things and you're like, well, maybe they're just having a bad day, or maybe, you know, the topic of discussion was a little bit triggering. But, you know, when you sort of start to look at people, the grand total of the person, it's just like, oh, boy, you know, something's not right. You know, I even had a student who, you know, we would give assignments. And again, this is a coordinated course, and I would get different assignments back. And, you know, I said, well, what's this? Well, I thought it would be better if, you know, this type of assignment was assigned. So that's what I did. You know,
I created my own assignment. Yeah. Here you go. Yeah. Try creating this.
Right. And when I feel like, you know, you give me some feedback that's worthy of me reading, then, you know, I'll meet with you to talk about, my progress in the class. And this person has graduated. You know, so
go figure, huh?
Go figure.
Well, Dr. Daniels, we are going to return after this break, okay?
Okay.
Therapy cable is the missing piece in the puzzling question, what is the role of the cyber world in healthcare? Therapy cable has created a marketplace where healthcare finally meets technology in a consumer-friendly way. We use online technology to bring together various entities of healthcare in one central place. It's easy to access from any internet platform. We provide educational videos on topics like acupressure, medicine, psychotherapy, and yoga. You can confidentially use this information in the privacy of your home. You can stay connected to the provider of your choice or even see your provider in person. Get started today at therapycable.com.
And welcome back to Psych 101. This is Julianne Good, and I'm with Dr. Trevor Daniels this evening. We are talking about Black psychology and just the psychology field in general. I think it's kind of sprouted out here, and I think a lot of people don't understand what students go through and the sacrifices they make to get through the programs. I know I'm in my eighth year now, straight through from my bachelor's into my doctorate degree right now. And I have had to sacrifice quite a bit, especially for the master's program. And a lot of people do stop at their master's program because that seems to be just about the hardest part of the educational process is that 3 years. Now, it used to be 2 years. But for marriage and family therapy is now 3 years. And so that third year of education, people are, you know, writing their papers and having to study for the comprehensive examinations and doing more extensive work and having to work in their practicum hours. And their practicum hours are not paid. Mm. You know, it goes towards their licensing, but you know, so a lot of people have to also have like at least a part-time job on top of it and take out student loans. Mm-hmm. So there's so many components to having to get your psychology degree and your licensing, you know. So I think, but that's really part of the process of maturing and really being able to sit with a client or a patient and get yourself out of the equation temporarily right. So that you can be of benefit and you are not putting your problems onto them, which is called counter transference.
Right.
So right. It's that delicate balance. Right. And
well, what I will offer anybody who's a student and who's listening right now is, yes, you know, money is always an issue, but you know, what I did, because I went to school from the time I graduated high school, I went to school until I was 30 years old, you know, just straight through all psychology degrees, undergraduate, master's degree, you know, doctorate degree, and actually two masters. Mm-hmm. And I always worked in the field. So, you know, I always had, you know, jobs, you know, that sort of, you know, helped with the education I was receiving. But when it came to, you know, practicums, internships, I just simply would not apply for anything that was not paying. If it was $300 a month, I applied to it because every little bit helps. So right. That's what I will offer. But, you know, in terms of, getting yourself out of the equation, I want to go back to something you just said, you know, after the break. So we sort of started off talking about Black psychology, but it did sort of, you know, sprout out. And I want to make it clear that, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, the white psychologist, the Black psychologist, the psychologist of color, we all need to be multiculturally competent, period. And, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about Black psychologists was because the numbers are just so small.
Yes, they are.
But really, you know, we can have incompetent Black psychologists. Just because you're Black, you know, doesn't mean that you understand all Black people or people of color or, you know, the relevant issues. So, you know, this is really a discussion for everyone. But, you know, we talk about getting ourselves out of the equation. We talk about, you know, practicing in a way in which we respect, you know, the environment, you know, the cultures, the values of the person that we're working with, excuse me. And you heard me use this term ethnocentric monoculturalism earlier. And so that's sort of this idea that the values and beliefs and assumptions and practices of society are structured in a way that only the very small segment of society benefits. So if we are talking about, you know, U.S. society, we're talking about, you know, the WASP, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, you know, the males, you know, they're the only ones who benefit. You know, they hold all the power. They make all the decisions. They define reality for everybody. And if we, you know, sort of look at that a little, you know, further, we're talking about people who believe that they are superior. You know, their culture is superior, which inevitably means that everyone else is inferior. You know, they can impose standards. A white psychologist in the program that I most recently, you know, taught in, you know, she said, well, you know, what kind of, she was, you know, talking about me veiled. We didn't get along too well, you know, but this veiled sort of, you know, what kind of mental health, you know, issues does a person have who, you know, has graduated, you know, 10 years ago and, you know, and doesn't have a private practice. Well, you know, who are you to define the reality of what one's career should be?
Right.
You know, my career is just fine. You
yeah.
know, had a job at graduation. So what are you talking about?
And you get to decide where you want to go.
Yeah, and I can decide where I want to go.
Right.
But the idea is that, you know, if you are not presenting yourself in the world as such, then you don't matter. You know, there's something wrong with you. A psychologist in a program, you know, that professes, you know, diversity and social justice said that.
Right. Well, and the whole thing too, more research oriented.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's different, way different mindset for
right.
psychologists who should be going into just mainly doing research. And
right.
people who are practicing mm-hmm. and being with people and trying to help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I have seen some people who, you know, are coming in from the research end and trying to connect with people and just not making that connection.
Right. Right.
So really,
because
just belong in the research
is,
world.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And hopefully somebody tells them along the line, maybe you'd be better off if you went that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, choose yeah. more of that realm and stuff because, you know, there's always
yeah.
more research to be done. It, you know, this is
right.
this is a soft science. This is always, we're always going to be changing. I mean, there are certain theories and ideas that will stand the test of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, still, even some of Freud's theories are still relevant. But, you know, things change with the society.
Right.
And
right.
we do have a rapidly changing society. We do mm. have more globalization. We do have more people that are going from different countries and transplanting for whatever reason, you know, and having issues
right. Right.
because they're not back and in their home turf.
Right.
You know, and,
yeah.
and we need to have compassion with people for how courageous they have to be for all of the mm. barriers that they've had to go through.
Right.
to be here.
Yeah. And the important thing is where, you know, one of the places where we need to start is that this ethnocentric monoculturalism manifests itself in all of the institutions.
Right.
That, you know, serve as the foundations for our society.
Yes.
And so we have to start there. And so you mentioned Sue and Sue earlier, and a lot of people have issues with Sue and Sue's book. Mm. I think, you know, I've read it like, you know, 8-9 times because I taught this class,
right.
You know, and they came out with a new edition. You know, if you really, you know, look at what they're saying, they're giving suggestions. And so when we're talking about working with people from a multicultural perspective, we're talking about helping roles as process, you know, as process. So we're in a helping role, but what is the process? We need to, you know, be expansive in our thinking. What we do with people need to be consistent with their life experiences and cultural values. So we all get depressed, but how we talk about that depression, whether you are, you know, from one of the Hispanic cultures, whether you are African-American, Black, whether you are white, Asian, Pacific Islander, it may be completely different. And what one may do is completely different.
And depression can manifest in so many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Like in a lot of cultures, it'll be physical symptoms.
Right.
Even if there's mm-hmm. really nothing there, they've gone to their medical doctor, there's nothing wrong mm-hmm. with them, they check out physically, mm-hmm. and they still present like going, oh, well, I have, you know, a lot of times I get clients with, I have chest pain.
Right.
You know, which a lot of times is held in grief. They just can't express mm-hmm. it. It gets stuck right there.
Right. Or people are depressed about, you know, some type of family dynamic, and you tell, you know, the young Asian student, well, you know, you need to stand up to your parents. You need to do X, Y, and Z.
That doesn't work.
Does not work for the large majority, you know, of Asian identified individuals. And so there's this idea that there are individual, group, and universal dimensions of existence. And so we have to respect that, you know, when we are working with clients. You know, there are universal and cultural specific strategies. If someone, you know, is, you know, suffering from schizophrenia or something like that. Okay, so medication, you know, may be one thing. But then how does the family group, how does the community, you know, deal with that type of thing? Individualism and collectivism. So we're talking about systems of ecology. You know, we belong to a system. So I am working, you know, with a particular client, and because they are going to change some type of way, inevitably the system that they are in is going to be altered as well. And so can we speak to that? And then, you know, client systems, you know, so, you know, that's multicultural counseling. But then when we talk about cultural competence, you know, we bring it back to the practitioner, him or herself. So, you know, what are my own, you know, assumptions and biases and values,
right.
And, you know, how, you know, are they juxtaposed against those of the client, you know, that I'm working with? When are they getting in the way? Can I, you know, sort of set them aside and allow, you know, space, you know, for the person to be who they are? I had one student who hated organized religion and, you know, wrote in the paper, I just cringe every time I hear people say God and I'm going to pray and I just think these poor people. And I said, well, wait a minute. You can think whatever you want, but you have to allow the space for the person, you know, to, you know, have that part, you know, of them come into your work with them, because that's going to be very important.
Right.
You know, so you have to be aware of your assumptions.
Exactly. You have to be honest with yourself.
Yeah.
And we are going to wrap this up.
Yes.
Yes. So thank you so much for being on. If the listeners would like to contact you, how can they do that?
They can reach me at drtadaniels@gmail.com. That's doctor spelled out. T as in Tom, A as in Alan, daniels@gmail.com.
And D-A-N-I-E-L-S, correct?
Correct.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Daniels. It was just wonderful to have you on again.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And to the listeners, if you would like to contact me, you can do so at jgoode8@verizon.net. My office number is 562-209-1837. My office is located in Santa Ana, California. And please contact me if I can assist you in any way. You can contact me by Facebook or by Twitter. It'd be wonderful to hear from you. And I'd love to hear your suggestions for future shows. Want you to be involved, and I want you to take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye now.